Hello, and welcome to the Careless Talk Climbing Podcast. Today we have the second part of my interview with co-host Aidan Roberts. In this part, we talk a little bit about Burden of Dreams. We talk about how Aidan is trying to be a sort of eco-conscious professional climber. And we also have a little bit snuck in there for everyone who's brave enough to stick it out about training, which is hidden away at the end. But I must encourage you not to skip on to that and cut everything else completely, because there's some good stuff in there, I promise. All right. Cheers.
But now, so for most people, I always felt that this would be the bit that they would find harder to talk about. But with you, I reckon this will be the bit that you find easier to talk about. Because I want to talk about something that didn't necessarily go your way. And we're going to go way back, because you mentioned it briefly. Uh-huh. But you went to Finland to try Burden of Dreams.
Yeah.
Like, how did that come about?
What made me want to go there?
Yeah, how did you get that in your head as something that you were actually going to do? Because, like, the thing with Burden of Dreams is that it's notorious for two things. Well, three things, I guess. But one is it's thought, you know, really, really, really hard. Two, it's pretty inaccessible in that it's, like, it's not exactly in, you know, Font or, like, middle of Switzerland. It's somewhere that comparatively few people go. But three, it's supposed to be really conditions dependent. Like, I'm pretty sure that Gnarly said there was at least one season, I think, where he barely was able to go on it because of the conditions were so bad.
Yeah, no, very bad conditions.
So
like, I had like, yeah.
Those three things together, I think, make it like, right now, I think that's the boulder that most people will be excited to see repeated in the world.
Yeah, I think what drew me towards that is I really made the decision not to do competitions, and doing competitions, your goals are like prescribed. Like, you have dates and you have competitors you're competing against. So like, you almost, it's like done for you. But when I was climbing outside, like I had my season in end of summer in 2020, where I did most of the projects I had locally, like in the Lake District. And I was kind of like, the other bits that I had to do, I didn't need to improve, or like the things I'd tried in the UK, I felt like I could do them at the level I was at.
Mm.
And I've always liked personal development. Like, I've always liked just getting better at the things I do. And it felt like nothing I was trying was like ensuring that, like, as in, like, I'd train to improve, but like, I was like, why am I training when all the things I'm trying, I could just try them and I could maybe do them. So I was really looking for something that was ambitious and require me to progress in order to do it. So yeah, maybe you could say it didn't go my way or it was a failure, but actually I found exactly what I wanted for too.
Yeah.
Going out to Finland. I like tried it. The boulder felt so hard. Sure, there's factors out of your control. It's extremely hard to get good conditions. But like,
did you get decent-ish conditions? What were the conditions like?
I had one session where it felt noticeably better, but very humid. Got very cold at times. Too cold for me. Like, it was hard. Like, yeah, it rained a lot. Like, it was like definitely a limiting factor. Skin was a limiting factor. I think I had 5 splits at one point. Like, it was like a bit of a rocky road on that account. So it was like factors out of my control that didn't go my way, but no denying that I just wasn't good enough, which was not like, as in like, felt humbling, but nice. Like, I'm excited by it. Like, the prospect of like, wow, I need to get a lot better. And like, it's not so much a style I thought it would suit me a lot better than it did.
Because you thought they were more like in cut the holds, or
yeah, I like moving slow. Like I like being able to slow down moves to get holds precisely.
Mm.
Whereas yeah, the holds are actually much flatter than I realized, and like you've required to move like really powerfully between these positions. You can't keep much weight in the feet, but they have to stay on. Mm. I usually like putting a lot of weight through my feet. So like, it was a very different style of movement to what I'm used to, but it's like something which I'm quite excited to improve. And I think it will like,
so it feels more like, front wheel drive, as they say, it's more upper body focused and less weight through the feet, that boulder, or, you just weren't able to get enough weight through the feet.
It's a weird, like, yeah, okay, if we go into the climb specifics of it, it feels physically, obviously, really hard. It feels like a skill as well. So, like, generating, I could generate fine. Like, the holds, like, feel on each of the moves, I could generate and get my hand on the next hold totally fine. In the positions, I could hold them, like, I could hold them and be, like, comfortable. Like, I feel like I could add weight onto the positions. So, like, it's all there to do the move. But actually executing it, it felt like there was such a small window. Like, I have to move my arms so quickly. Like, I have to, like, keep weight in the foot. And, like, it felt like physically, just, like, the physical strength of what was acquired didn't feel like it was so much of the limiting factor. Like, well, I mean, I obviously wasn't as strong as I probably need to be for it, but like, I feel like it's much more of a skill of like being much more powerful, which is a style I've always struggled at as well. Like moving really fast, being really precise in those movements. And I kind of quite look forward to progressing in that style. And it's something I probably wouldn't have done had I not gone and tried a boulder that was too hard for me.
Hmm.
So like, it doesn't feel.
But you didn't know it was too hard for you when you set off.
No, not at all. I definitely didn't expect to do it, but I obviously hoped that I could. Like,
or even would.
Yeah. I hope that I would. Yeah, like, I went up to the boulder and I was kind of like, oh, like. You kind of, it's hard to tell. You go there and it doesn't look like the hardest thing in the world. And I was kind of like feeling the holds. I was like, wow, like maybe I could do this. Like,
yeah. So here's a big question as well. The very first go you had on it, did you try and flash it?
I pulled on from the start.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't have any, I hadn't thought about flashing.
Yeah.
I pulled on from the start because it felt like the obvious place to pull on, but I didn't have any part of myself that think I would flash it. But actually, the first go I had on the first move, I was like, wow, that's not so bad.
Yeah.
The whole rest of the month, I it was very hard to see progress on that. Like,
move. How long were you there for?
Just under a month.
Oh, God, that's quite a long time.
Yeah, it was a long time. And I had 10 days where I didn't try because my skin was so bad.
Yeah. Well, 10 straight days.
Yeah.
You had to rest for 10 straight days just because of your skin.
I didn't rest, so...
Oh, you did other stuff.
We went to climbing walls, and there's other areas. There's a place called Sipo, which I went to as well. I think it was 10 days. No, I think I had 7 days off that boulder. Had one session where I warmed up and was like, I can't try this in tape. And then, like, went... It was like 10 days before I had a proper session on it again. So like, it definitely was a limiting factor. I think like, were I to do that boulder, it would be a case of being physically more than capable of doing it, like having some leeway there. I assume this must have been the case for Nally as well. Or I guess being local, he can just try it until all the factors align up. But it feels like for me, because I will only go there very irregularly, probably... I'd ideally like to not go many times, tied into travel considerations, but
we'll get to that
later. I feel like the way I would do that climb would be to like be over prepared for it, and when the conditions window align like enough, then
go quickly,
and then it's like not like go to it knowing that I could comfortably do it, and then just like weighing all those other factors.
So how many moves is it roughly?
Five moves.
It's five moves. And of those five moves, how many of them did you do?
From day one, I did the middle three moves. I linked the middle three moves on my second session. I like did from like the first move, you do like a foot walk and then three moves. And I didn't do the first or the last move.
Right. Were you close on either of them or not?
I felt close on both of them, actually. Mm. Yeah. No, they definitely did feel achievable, for sure.
But I think I heard secondhand from someone else that you got a really, really bad split. It was really bad.
Yeah, it was a flapper, but yeah.
Like a fissure.
Pretty much lost my fingertip.
And was that on that was on that boulder that happened?
Yeah.
First
yeah.
move, was
last,
it?
Last move.
Last move.
Yeah, dry fired.
Yeah, because once, I mean, how quick is your skin to recover?
So actually I think the first two sessions were the only sessions I didn't have tape. I got to the point where like near the start I was excited and tried it when I probably shouldn't be trying it, and once I started splitting it was then a vicious cycle.
Yeah,
like, tape would then move and I'd split another tip.
Savage.
I made some tactical errors,
but like in a sense it's so hard to avoid splits, isn't it? Like I know, like, do you know Mason, Dave Mason?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he always says that, like, some bowlers, it's, like, one go.
Yeah, oh,
like,
yeah.
Or two goes. Like, his skin is really, really, like...
Yeah.
It's, like, a high tendency to split.
Yeah.
And I know, like, I've seen him on some stuff where it's, like, I need to warm up, and then I'll probably get one, two goes, maybe three.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's a certainty that he's got a split. Which is just like, that is a really heavy burden to have to carry as a climber. Like, that is very limiting.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
climbing with splits sucks.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's really painful. And the pain inhibition, like the automatic pain inhibition of your body, makes it just impossible to fully load something that's like really hurting you. You know, we can't, you know, it's a reflex. Like, you can't fight the pain inhibition reflex 100%.
Yeah.
So you just can't pull once it's hurting like that.
Yeah.
And climbing in tape sucks. Like, I'm so impressed when I see people climbing hard stuff in tape, because as soon as I put tape on, I feel hopeless.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's difficult. But coming back to your question, things that don't go my way, it's nice. I like kind of do genuinely feel that if you are constructive in that, you think you can't really, like, okay, maybe you mentioned the story of trying a new baseline, that's a failure because you know, like, it doesn't work for you. But like, failure seems like a very extreme term for something that is gonna long outlive you. I feel like, I don't really feel like you can fail so much, pretty much down to the timeless nature of rock.
Yeah. So I think this is like the thing that we're touching on that I'm like really fascinated by, is that you seem like so able to turn what, objectively speaking, is a failure into something which isn't one. You know, like, if you go out to try one boulder in deepest, darkest Finland, and like, which isn't, it's not like you were, you know, that was on your way to the shops. That's like a long way out of your way to do one boulder. Because I mean, I'm sure you did other boulders and you're out there, but like, I couldn't name a second boulder in Finland. Sorry to our myriad Finnish listeners. I'm sure they'll be clamoring to tell me. Yes, you went all the way to do that one boulder and you didn't do it. So objectively speaking, like, that should be a failure, really. I mean, I know you can go back and you can do it again, but like, that trip, it's a failure from the objective sense, but you seem so able to like not see it that way.
Yeah, I think inevitably that part of me was like hoping that I would.
Yeah, of course. Trip.
Like,
yeah.
Inevitably, but like, I don't know. I like to think I can be quite rational when I know certain thoughts aren't helpful or useful. So like, if it is a reality, being frustrated by it is not going to change that reality to like, kind of, I feel like I can engage with that quite well. So like, to be disappointed or demotivated that I didn't do the climb in that trip isn't going to help me in any way. I'm just going to feel a bit crap.
Yeah.
So obviously it's a bit of an ideal, but perhaps it's just, I think maybe that like kind of rational thinking is something that I'm relatively good at.
Yeah, well, I would actually say that's, could be your greatest strength.
Rational.
It could be.
Rational.
Because like, it is so rational, but humans aren't really that rational. Certainly not, emotions aren't rational. Like, and most of us, to fail is really damaging. You know, like we struggle with our ego, basically. Like if you go to try something that you hoped you would do and you do worse than you expected, most people take that pretty hard. I think it's hard to, you know, some people will admit it. Some people wear their heart on their sleeves and will be like, you know, screaming and throwing their boulder buckets around and like kicking their shoes down the mountain or whatever. But
looks like a bad time.
Yeah. But or they'll, you know, they'll just sulk. I'm much more of the sulker, but like most people are affected pretty badly by it. It's, I'm really like desperately trying to find some time when you like really felt like this is a failure. It's, I've not achieved what I wanted to achieve. And I wonder if, because you climb a lot by yourself, don't you? And you also spend a lot of time by yourself.
Yeah. I
think, and you spend a decent amount of that time sort of thinking over these sort of things.
Yeah, no, definitely. Do most of my thinking in solitude, I'd say.
It's an amazing, like, monastic sentence. But yeah, you do most of your thinking in solitude with a kind of, monk life almost.
Monk life.
Another classic boulder. But I wonder if that time allows you to kind of really think things through. Where maybe being on a trip and then playing Uno in the evenings with a bunch of like idiots probably doesn't give other people enough time to really think those sort of things through.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, playing Uno with a load of friendly idiots is amazing. But no, I am actually, I do think there is a lot of value in that, like thinking time, but like also being solitary, like, I have definitely become aware of like how much authentic you are when only you are there. Like inevitably, like I like to think that I wouldn't say I'm confident, but I'm confident about who I am. I don't try and necessarily be somebody else for other people, but like to a degree, everyone is like, I'm always going to like, act differently around people, kind of like maybe like I'm not gonna just be completely transparent like with anyone. I kind of will want to be the person maybe I think they'll want to be to a certain, they'll want me to be to a certain degree, but like obviously when you're by yourself you've got nothing to prove to anyone, like you can be like so authentic, which I think you can learn a lot from, and often people maybe don't get, well, I don't know. I feel like when I wasn't spending as much time by myself, like I maybe never got the opportunity to have that so much. I think it's very valuable anyway.
Yeah. So this, like, this is another thing, isn't it? There is a very small group, or maybe it's not as small, but because I don't know about them, I think it's small, but like, there's a small group of climbers who are kind of like deliberate dark horses almost, like they don't want to talk too much about their achievements. There's something, there's the bit that most of us have where, like, if I climbed one of the really hard climbs that you did on one of your Rocklands trips, like, even though I hate social media for many ways, I would still spend a good week building the biggest possible megaphone I could so I could yell about it from a boulder, because I can't help myself. Like, even though I would hate myself for it, if I did something really hard, the thought of not being able to tell anybody and have them say, wow, well done, that, like, that would be too much for me. But one of the other climbers that I would think of as like a dark horse deliberately is someone that was very involved with you when you were getting into climbing. So when you were, you know, your climbing career was in its infancy, when you were a nascent crusher, you spent a lot of time with Dan Varian, didn't you?
Yeah.
And he is a deliberate dark horse, surely.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like, very few people have heard of.
Because, like, he's done, like, everyone in UK know he's, like, an amazing climber and he's done loads of stuff, but I couldn't tell you anything that he's done in the last 10 years. I've no idea, because he doesn't have an Instagram account, I don't think, does he?
Unless
it's hidden away somewhere.
Yeah, no.
He doesn't have an Instagram account, and he doesn't really tell anybody. I don't see, like, UKC articles going up, but I presume he's still out there climbing hard stuff.
Yeah, he definitely does it on the down low. But, yeah, perhaps that is...
I just wonder if, like,
significant, yeah.
Did that imprint on you when you were so, you know, when you were more an impressionable climber? You know, was he saying to you, did he kind of, like, suggest to you that perhaps that was the cooler way of doing it? Or did you just think, like, wow, this guy's amazing, look up to him, and then kind of emulate him a bit?
Yeah, no, we definitely never had that conversation. But I think perhaps one of the things I was really... Like, he was definitely a role model for me growing up. But one of the things I think I was really inspired by was how passionate he was about doing stuff purely because he loved doing it. Like, as in, like, he would put so much effort to these climbs. Like, he would, like, spend days building landings, like, kind of, like, cleaning up these boulders in some esoteric places and do these climbs. And not tell anyone, like, which, like, he just loves doing it. And, like, if there are people that come and visit, like, he will show them the climbs. It's not like he's, like, protective about them. Like, it's like, I was always inspired by how much he does it because he loves doing it. Like, it's, like, something he's really passionate about. And I think it's so rare that you can... that there are people that are doing that, and there's a lot of people saying they're doing that, but it's very hard when there's, like, a cloud of, like, a social media presence to back it up with not excessive sponsorship, but, like, when somebody's livelihood is dependent on it, like, suddenly, like, they're almost, like, paid to big themselves up as well, like.
Yeah. I mean, then we sort of lead ourselves into the issue that climbing really has, in that the only way a professional climber is going to make money is, you know, like, with sponsorship, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Obviously someone like Dan is outside of that, because obviously he makes the Beastmaker and is able to kind of pay his own way, but
yeah,
that allows him to be a dark horse in a sense, because he's making his own money. But for many people, there's no other way than through Instagram and this kind of nauseating constant self-promotion that leads into.
Yeah, no, for sure. Which is, yeah, kind of a shame. I, like, inevitably, it makes total sense that sponsors require their athletes to be known. So, like, somebody who was a complete dark horse just went out and did their climbs, nobody ever heard of anything they did. There's absolutely no reason for a company to sponsor them. Like, there has to be some, like, transactional basis on that relationship. So it does make sense. I'm not saying that that's a shame. I think it's just more a shame of, like, what is more of a shame is, like, the way in which social media encourages people to react with, like, the community, in that, like,
if you don't scream and shout about everything you do and big it up, you'll just get lost in a pile of people who do.
Yeah.
A pile of people who do. Yeah. Which, like, feels like a shame because, like, yeah, I don't know if that does.
It's always been the case of, like, the people who get the most money aren't necessarily the best climbers, because you have to be a good climber. But to a brand, you know, if you're trying to sell a product, it doesn't really matter if you're the best or not. You've got to be the best saleable product, you know, like, yeah. So like it's only one small piece, yeah, of the overall kind of pie. You've got to be a really strong climber. That's one thing ticked. But there are also like loads of kids and younger people out there who are, you know, you hear that because they're a really strong climber, they almost feel like they're owed sponsors and those sponsors should be paying me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I say, why?
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah.
You know,
it's only one small piece.
Yeah, that's puzzle. One bit. You've also got to be able to get the message out there, and be the sort of person that, you know, people would follow.
Yeah.
I
think it's almost been a bit of an illusion that that wasn't always the case. Like, I feel like that's always been the case. It's just like the exposure of the athletes was done in a different manner. Now it's all done like on a personal basis where everyone like runs their own like media presence, which is actually quite a strange way of doing it. Like, you almost leave the responsibility to like the way in which someone presents themselves, they present their own character. You leave the responsibility to that person, which feels like a quite strange way of doing it for me, because inevitably people are going to try and present themselves in the way in which is most appealing to the community,
yeah,
which like perhaps is not an accurate representation of who that person is.
The fun bit for me is when you do learn something about them because they present themselves in the way that they think is the best way to present themselves or like what people want. But sometimes I feel like that's kind of skewed and it's not necessarily what people want. So you do learn what at least that person thinks I want to say, you know, like just like the general climbing public.
But I think that's where we come to social media as a thing. I think that's so, it's super sad that people, because sponsorship, their livelihood relies upon that they feel the need to present themselves as somebody that they're not. I think it's just sad, but just a trait that social media is always going to hold.
Exactly. Like, it's just the internet in general and Instagram's the current frontier of it. It's the airbrushing and the revisionist history that I find so painful.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and this is another reason why I really wanted to do this podcast, is like, it's that huge gap in climbing-based storytelling, which is the stuff, everything that happens away from the champagne moment and the success.
Yeah.
Like, which is 99.99% of it. And all of that is lost to time because we only record, here's me on Boulder, you know, or like, even here's a video of me doing the Boulder, and then like, a pathetic effort at like a meaningful quote or something.
Yeah. it's such a snapshot.
You hear people saying that you don't learn anything from success and you only really learn from failure. And it's a little bit reductive, but there's a kernel of truth to that, definitely. And I think we all are poorer for it because we can't learn from everyone else's failures because no one says anything about it.
You don't hear
anything. So like that kind of what we were talking through there about like how you're able to recalibrate in your mind what would appear externally to be a failure into success, I think that kind of thing is really helpful for people to hear. And like that's something where they can learn from you in a sense. Whereas like, oh, Aiden's done Olifant's Dawn. It's like, that doesn't help me.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's a very selfish viewpoint because I'm trying to turn all of your like life experiences and how they affect me. But like, I can't, that doesn't help anybody.
Yeah.
And that's what we give people. That's what the climbing world gives to newer climbers and younger aspiring climbers, or just older climbers who are, you know, really into it. That's what we give them. Just,
yeah,
I've ticked a boulder.
Which is quite interesting because, like, it's also what people want to hear, but what is not necessarily good for them. Like, as in, like,
yeah,
people aren't that interested to hear, like, in which, what climbs people don't do. Like, but it's probably quite good for them to know that everyone fails.
I think, like, I wouldn't ever recommend to anybody, like, to just list their failures. That would be an awful thing to do. But, like,
actually, failure is an extreme language.
Yeah.
Haven't yet done.
Yeah, yeah. but like, something that didn't go their way, and then kind of like, how that kind of affected them mentally, I think is so valuable for people to hear. And it's just absent. And it's just...
Yeah.
Like, I wish I had the ability to completely set my ego aside and be like, I'm going to delete Instagram and walk away from it completely, because I feel it is mostly content which helps nobody.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so vacuous. And it's like, and it draws that part of ourselves where, like, it draws it out of us to be competitive, to be just self-indulgent,
yeah,
and to kind of like zoom in too much into climbing and like miss all the lessons that you could be learning or sharing to the community. It's just gone,
yeah,
hidden behind this like name of boulder, grade, video, and then 90 hashtags.
Yeah, there's a big gap amongst there which make a person, aren't
they? Yeah, yeah, it's just lost, and it's just like trying to keep as many people to look at it and therefore like it and maybe even follow them.
Yeah,
it's hit the bell notification and yeah, subscribe.
Yeah, no, it is it's a sorry state of affairs.
It is. I can't see it getting any better. That's the really negative point, I guess.
Yeah.
That's the, like, if you really kind of think about it, that's the saddest way of looking at it. But I just can't see how we can get out of this hole we've dug.
Yeah, I do agree. There's definitely no end in sight.
Yeah, it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, it's become like a metric for so many things in that sense, as in, like, it's hard to, yeah, step away from that. With I do think it's, well, I don't know of any, if we bring this back to climbing, I don't know of any like professional climber that doesn't use Instagram.
Yeah, who make loads of money from it. Sorry, like from climbing sponsors.
Yeah, yeah.
There really aren't many, are there?
I really can't think of any. Like, it is beginning to dominate, whereas, like...
There are some people that do it much better than others.
Yeah, no, it can be managed in a... And, like, I don't think it's inherently negative. Like, as in, like, there are great things about Instagram in that, like, you can instantly reach so many people. So if you have profound things to say...
Yeah, everyone would hear them.
Everyone can hear them. It's just the people who only say considered profound things kind of aren't the people that, like, they're not the pages which most people want to read.
Yeah.
Or like, so, well, it's kind of a thing, like, I don't know how many people follow me on Instagram, but I have quite a few people who follow me on Instagram, but like nowhere near as much.
Take a guess. I'm going to look you up right now. And I want you to guess genuinely as close as you think.
12,000.
You've undercut it. I knew you would. I knew you'd undercut it. 14.4. So you weren't that far off, but actually that's quite a long way off. But like,
yeah, no, like, okay, yeah. So that is quite a lot. That's obviously a lot of people, and I'm never going to speak to that many people. So it is like quite a lot of influence. But basically, where I was going with that is like,
I kind of make an effort to be authentic on social media and kind of say things when I feel like I have some things to say. Every now and again, I'm like, oh, actually,
yeah,
I should probably keep this ball rolling. But like, it doesn't do well, essentially. There's a lot of people who have massive followings on social media.
Yeah.
And like, I read their stuff and it's like, oh, they're talented climbers. But like, the things that they say, like, don't contribute anything to people. Like,
no.
So like, sharing ideas which are useful isn't popular.
Yeah, apparently not.
But like, which is a real shame.
Because it's the way that, it's just the whole popularity contest that Instagram has set up for itself. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Why, when you go on someone's page, does it need to tell you how many followers they have and how many people they follow?
Yeah.
That's irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. I'm not interested at all in how many followers someone else has. So, like, I can see why if a brand wants to approach someone, they could then say, I have this many followers and have some way of proving it, I guess. But, like, why does... And why I can't even opt out of it. I can't even say, stop telling me, I'm not interested. Like,
not
a choice, you must know.
As if more people looking their stuff gives them credibility of things that they say.
This person has more friends than you. You must listen to what they have to say.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
But you could have way more followers if you wanted to do that. Like, if you wanted to just do, right, every climb you do over the grade of whatever I will post about. Even if most of them were just a video of you doing the boulder, name and grade, and some hashtags,
yeah,
you would have way, way more followers if you wanted to do that.
Yeah, I think so. But I think, like maybe part lots of the thinking time that has occurred in more recent years, I've really tried to be a bit more considered about like the contributions I make. Perhaps generally to the world, and in this case to the climbing community. And it feels like climbing, like I've taken the decision to become a professional climber, and so this is the avenue in which I have influence at the moment. I'm not saying that I'm always going to be a professional climber. I've got other things which I think I will go into, but for the time being, like, this is the place where I will make my contributions. And the contributions I want to make, I don't want to just be like inspiring people to travel all around the world to try these hard boulders. Like, I at least want people to think a little bit more about the things they do. So perhaps that's like the motivation behind that. I'd rather have a more profound effect on less people than just... It's influence over thousands and thousands more.
It's this
more.
Like really radical view that you should say something worth saying when you shout about it to 14,000 people. Like, and yet that makes you the oddity, which I think is like,
sad.
That's how we sum up Instagram. Like, that is the, that's, you know, from Instagram's point of view, that's crazy. You're giving up all those posts that you're not doing because you didn't have anything worth saying, giving up followers, and followers means money.
Yeah,
and you're giving that up just because you want to be genuine, authentic.
But I do feel very fortunate in that the people who do like sponsor me, I have a much more personable relationship with. Obviously, it has to be transactional, but
yeah.
I think it's the only way, and this is like the only basis in which that would work, in that they like have some faith in what I am trying to do, because realistically, there are a lot of people who have 14,000 followers and don't make a living out of climbing.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, you've got the dream gig, haven't you? You've got Patagonia in the stable.
Yeah, it's really not so bad.
No, it's not so bad. And they don't even force you to post loads about Patagonia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is true. I think like, yeah, a big part of that, yeah, is like also, like there's other avenues in which is then a priority, which is quite nice. I think it's quite a progressive company in that sense. In that like perhaps that's not entirely where they assign their value, which is good. I think.
It's phenomenal. Like this, now that sustainability and conservation and that sort of thing are the forefronts of people's minds, there are so many companies that are just trying to do, open quotes, the right thing, because that will then people will buy my jackets.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we care about goose. Yeah. We make sure we only get well-treated goose in our down jacket. And it's all like a complete lie to get people to buy their stuff. So it's really lovely to hear a company that you think of as being quite moral, like Patagonia, are doing things behind the scenes that are still the right way of doing things. They're not just putting up that to make us buy the jackets and then behind closed doors yelling down the phone at you being like, you haven't sold your quota of joggers.
And it's hard to I can see why for other companies it's hard to build that up once you have built a company around just like profitability, to then be like, right, now we're going to be moral. Like,
yeah,
when the core of the company is profitability, like,
and you've got shareholders and they're all like,
my
premiums.
They've opted into extreme capitalism, whereas like I think it's like being built from the ground up on by moral people, perhaps.
Yeah, so like, and the thing is they do seem to sell a lot of stuff. Like, it seems to benefit them. So because it's working, you can see the other companies around them in the same sort of space. There are other companies that are just painfully trying to like be like, oh, we're like that too, we've done that stuff, guys. and like it's painful to watch because it's like so insincere. But yeah, it's great to hear that they don't force you into doing too much, because as you say, you don't want to just be using your platform to sell stuff.
And like allows you to allows me to put effort into perhaps different avenues.
But that there's that other thing that you very briefly touched on there, which was like, how did you get to Burden of Dreams? How did you travel there?
Well, it did take me 3 days. A series of I basically drove and got ferries, and then it did take 3 days, and it was very expensive.
Was it?
Well, yeah, so with travel, like traveling overland, especially driving, so I have been spending most of my time in a van, staying in these places in a van, and generally it's a lot more expensive, and from an emissions perspective, it's not significantly better. It's probably like about 2/3.
Okay.
Of the emissions generally. Maybe that's an average, but I made the, I kind of don't really know when I made that commitment, but to myself, I made that commitment, and everyone kind of seemed to pick up on it. Not to fly. And that was like, I think probably partly the motivation behind that is, well, actually definitely the motivation behind that was, I kind of at one point realized that I was developing influence over a community. And up until that point, I think I kind of never really realized, I never really thought of myself as having influence over the climbing community. And so it almost justified being such an opportunist, like just saying yes to all these amazing like offers to go to these amazing places in the world, because in my mind I was like, this is so privileged, like nobody lives this lifestyle, nobody gets these offers, like, so I'm just gonna be an opportunist, say yes to these. And like, sure, I was aware of the environmental impacts, but I was like justifying them on the basis that I was very much an exception. But then began to understand that I was so inspired by these world-class climbers, and like professional climbing is almost always involved relentless travel, like since it's been a thing.
The carbon footprint of the World Cup circuit is pretty dizzying.
Yeah, exactly. And so I kind of realized that I was inspired by all these climbers. Did just travel the world and develop incredible boulders all over the world. And I felt like at that time I was almost just following in their footsteps, which I wasn't so conscious about doing it at the time. And then I was like aware of the environmental impacts of so much traveling, but never really considered that I was kind of almost fulfilling that same role. And it was like, I'm always cautious about this because I don't want to appear ungrateful. Like, I was inspired by those people, and like, I'm really grateful for like the contributions they made to the sport, and also like the fact that they inspired me to like improve in this sport. But I kind of think that I wouldn't want to play that same role and then like inspire people to travel in the same way. And I think the moment where that became really clear to me is like, essentially I'd always looked to like have these meaningful climbing experiences in these venues all over the world where like I felt that was where they like all the great climbing lay. And it wasn't until I actually had some like fulfilling climbing experiences way closer to me that I realized that perhaps what I thought I was looking for wasn't always out there. And so felt like just by not traveling so much, it wasn't necessarily a detriment to the quality of my climbing experience. And so it felt like something I could hold myself to, because it didn't feel like actually like I was having any less of a climbing experience. Like, this is holding myself to like the commitment of not flying. And I kind of think that's something that I tried to, well, it's kind of, I do find it hard to talk about too openly, because it's like, it's very hard not to come across as like, oh, hey, look at me, like, yeah, I'm a do-gooder kind of thing.
Are you at all worried about looking like you're absolutely ruling it out and then wanting to fly again to go somewhere really cool?
Yeah, I guess like that is very true. Like, as in, and I'd like to think that obviously there'd be criticism in that case, but I feel like it's genuinely something I can hold myself to, in that there is anywhere I'd like to go within reason. Like, there's enough for me within some vague definition of locality. I can like get overland to enough places that they would fulfill any climbing lifetime. And I've really become to realize like how much traveling in that way has really developed like a respect I have for the journeys I take, which I think is somewhat hidden from us with the whole like airline industry. I think it's like a classic case where like the reality of what it is like hidden from us. Like, we're so detached from like, which like, it's almost, its convenience makes it its convenience is kind of, it's designed in such a way that it's so convenient that we don't even really realize what we're doing. So like, I feel like this is kind of a way in which I kind of really connect with the distances I travel. And like, I really appreciate when I do make these bigger journeys. Now, I also understand that I'm in a very fortunate position that I climb full time, and not everyone has the time to do it. So actually, like, I do try and think quite constructively, as in like, what is a functional advice to people. And what I've thought about more recently, had some good conversations with a guy came and joined me at the end of the trip in Switzerland, and we were discussing about the value in like trying to understand what we really look for on a climbing
a climbing trip or for any climbing experience, and not just to assume that what we look for is necessarily the same thing as the feats which inspire us. Like, you see any like climbing role model in the world and they'll be all over the place, and like, for most people, they don't need to go to all these places to have a great like climbing experience. Often, like, I'd like kind of really encourage people to really consider what they're looking for in a climbing trip,
so they can look for it closer to home.
Yeah, and kind of balance that with like some considerations of the effects that would have on the environment as well.
Okay, well, it seems it's a good opportunity to me to show my reasonable and balanced interviewing credentials.
Yes.
So I'm going to challenge you now. Yes. Because you said earlier about how like you didn't want to use your following to promote something that's probably inadvisable for most people to do. But
yeah.
I haven't seen you using it much as a platform to promote this either. I haven't seen... You have posted about it, but you're not like... shouting about it too much.
Is that
fair to say?
Yeah, I think I kind of don't really know whether that's like, okay, especially social media, I is something I struggle with, how to like kind of really discuss that subject, in that anyone can talk about anything on social media and it's very hard to come across as genuine and not just be like, oh, look, here's a quality of mine to show how much I care for everything. Like, I've kind of definitely been very hesitant to, like...
Are you worried about coming across a bit sanctimonious? You're worried about preachy?
Yeah, the preachiness, I think, like, does a lot more harm than good as well. As in, I want to... I think there's a lot of importance in authenticity and, like, this is something that is relatively new that I've committed. I've been aware of it, but like, it's still something I'm kind of figuring. I haven't done many trips in this way, and it's still something I'm like kind of figuring out and understanding like the value of, and feel there's a real importance to walk the walk before I talk the talk. So like, I'm happy to like discuss it, to like give my viewpoint, but it's very hard to give like real world advice. Like, you should do this. I feel it's very different to expressing how you want to do something.
Yeah.
To like imposing what you think others should do.
Yes. It's more for people to make an effort. Whatever that effort is, it's to make an effort, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it might not be possible for people to do what you've done, but there must be a way they can do something to be a little bit better environmentally.
Yeah. I think really it boils down to like just trying to maybe it's a bit like just trying to be like a bit I feel like it comes down to being kind, if that makes sense, or like kind of being thoughtful about what decisions you make, not just based on how it affects you, but how about it affects other people or the world around you.
Yeah, if
that makes sense.
And would you say definitively that you will never fly again?
I hope to hold myself to that.
Oh, like, wow, you are going for it then. You're going to try to not fly.
Yeah, like that is something which like, I feel like realistically, like, I don't know, it feels like it shouldn't be anything that significant. Like, yeah, I think so.
They're going for it. Because, I mean, you can get a boat to America. You know, you can.
Yeah, yeah.
There are ways of doing it.
There's other ways, yeah.
I can't. It wouldn't be easy to go somewhere like Australia or South America, though. That would be.
Yeah, no, and like, I definitely, like, I have.
New Zealand, that'd be rough.
Yeah, no, I do. There are, like, definitely places where, like, I don't think I will go, which, like, in some ways is quite sad. Like, I probably won't go to Rocklands again, and I loved Rocklands. And there was, like, there was things which, like, I would have liked to have done there, but I'm also very aware of, like, the quality and quantity of the stuff which I do have access to. And whilst that's the case, I don't know, I feel like I can make an effort to appreciate that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is that something that you would ever bring up with one of the climbers that is just jetting around the world all the time? Have you sort of tried to broach this with them, or?
Yeah, I find it very hard to bring up, like, and not seem critical.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel critical at all. But, like, I find it hard, yeah.
Because it does come across as very, like, preachy, maybe judgmental. Like, if I were to, like, bring it up in that scenario and to be like, oh, look, I'm not flying, why are you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I don't really mean that in the slightest. It's more just, like, it's nice for me to know and hopefully somewhat, I mean, I'm sure there are other people doing that as well, but, like, somewhat sets a precedent that you can climb professionally and not need to travel. Like,
yeah,
it's, like, quite nice to know that they're not, like, completely distinct things.
So you're mostly focusing on Europe then? That's where it's much more feasible drive, because you're presumably going to aim to drive then to everywhere.
Yeah.
This train is a bit.
Yeah. It's quite hard to get around.
Incredibly long Uber.
And I think also, like, the way I've kind of, I think with much longer trips as well works well, because
like,
driving to
you've got your van as well.
Yeah, it's never a great solution. And sure, like, I'm driving around in a fuel inefficient van.
Well, that was going to be another thing I was going to say. Surely you should be looking to try and get an electric van.
Yeah, I would love to. Sadly, far outside the budget of a pro climber salary, but or one of my caliber anyway. But
that would be the dream, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be ideal.
You could run off a huge solar panel,
line the roof. yeah. No, but I do think, like, much longer trips, and I found I can manage it. I go to, like, a venue like Caronica was a good example when I was in Switzerland, and once I park up there, barely move at all. like it's like mostly gets you there, and then you kind of, like, stay in a single location for multiple weeks, and it kind of becomes much more justifiable.
Yeah, so okay, so that's that. But if we recently go back to your time in Caronica, which you relatively recently come back from.
Yeah.
You were there for 2 months, mm-hmm. was it?
Yeah, so yeah, I was in Switzerland for 2 months, yeah. So.
And how much of that time was by yourself, and how much of that was with other people?
So the first 2 weeks was with my friends Jim and Sam. And then how long was that? I was there for 9 weeks in total. So yeah, then the middle 5 weeks was myself, and then my friend Timo joined as well for the last couple of weeks.
Mm.
And then I had a little bit at the end of the trip by myself as well. But yeah.
Is that something, did that work? Did that trip, was it everything you wanted it to be?
Yeah, no, for sure. I actually think it worked out really well. I had a really nice balance between the social playing Uno with a load of free.
Okay, another phrase.
Had a nice bit of that time, and then yeah, a lot of solitary thinking time, and also meeting new people or getting to know new people. I've always found much easier when I'm traveling alone, which has also always been really nice. And then also actually just making the most of being alone as well. And I do enjoy that kind of time. So yeah, it was kind of like, I think it worked out really well. For sure, quiet and rest days can sometimes
drag on. What was a rest day? When you're totally by yourself in a van, there must have been quite a few rest days, which was that just you in a van.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Obviously you don't have to stay to the van, but what do you do for a whole set of rest days?
I'd definitely look for boulders. There's multiple rivers I explored, and kind of, yeah, would go on swims, walks. I do a decent bit of writing, kind of mostly for myself. Yeah, read some stuff, a lot of stretching.
Yeah, but quite... you feel quite happy and content, like you're not just... Yeah. Because I would be bored, man.
Yeah, for sure got bored at times, but like, I think it was actually quite nice. So it's generally a thing that I've really struggled with in the past is feeling the need to have something to show for my time.
Like, right.
All the time. And so at times, that, like in the past, I think I'd have really struggled with this. But I actually think it did so much good for my mental health.
Right, just to completely zone out from time to time.
Yeah, exactly that. And there was a nice, there's actually a really nice phase where I like ran out of data on my phone. And so like basically wasn't using my phone, which like was really, I think really good for me. It was like I went to uni in London and lived a crazy hectic lifestyle. And like, it's like such a stark contrast. It's like a detox from like the crazy world.
Yeah, probably good for most people, to be honest.
Yeah, no, it definitely felt, yeah. It felt austere at times, but I think...
But I mean, at the point that you're a man by himself in a van without access to the internet, I think to the outside world, I think you become a hermit.
Yeah.
and I think just telling like the ordinary people, I was doing it to climb rocks. I don't think that would make them think any less of you as a hermit. Yeah,
that justifies it.
Yeah, that would make you more hermit-esque.
Yeah, come to think of it. Yeah, wouldn't change it for the world.
But and so that will be, when's the next time you're going to set off across the channel?
So I think I'll stick around the UK until autumn now, which...
And then what's calling you in autumn?
Well, I'm kind of thinking about committing most of this, well, really focusing this summer on training, and I'm looking to, if I feel prepared, go back to Finland, probably, around late September or so.
Is that as good as the conditions get, supposedly?
I went a bit later last year. I went like kind of like mid-October to mid-November. And it was definitely getting a bit cold. I don't find I need it quite so cold because I have relatively dry skin anyway. So I was thinking of going a little bit earlier this year. But I'll probably only go back if I feel properly prepared for that. And if not, I'm very content on return trip to Switzerland.
That'd be the backup plan.
Yeah, and were I not to head straight there, I would probably come back via that way, on my way back after Finland.
Is there anywhere outside of Switzerland and Finland that you'd be interested in?
Oh, definitely. I'd like to spend some time in Font.
Yeah.
A little while. A lot I'd like to do there.
When was your last sort of extended trip in Font? Were you there for like, yeah, at least a week or so?
Probably like 4.5 years ago or so.
Wow, that is quite a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, because you're frequently driving past.
Yeah, not far away.
Some of the best bouldering in the world.
Though actually only once, because when I went to Finland, I went by Amsterdam, so missed it. But yeah, this time. I went past. Yeah, yeah. I actually did contemplate Font. On the way there. Would have been the best time on the way back. It was getting quite hot.
Yeah, because didn't you ended up actually coming back from Switzerland a little bit earlier than you planned, didn't you?
I think a few days, yeah. It did get too warm.
So it got really hot, didn't it?
Yeah, it got really warm and really humid. Ended up swinging back a little bit early.
Broadly speaking, are you more excited about the Burden of Dreams than the Sean project that you were trying?
No, I'm actually very keen for both of them. I feel like the one I tried in Switzerland, yeah, the one Sean did recently, definitely suited me better, or the way I was trying it suited me better. And it felt at the end of that trip, like I knew I could have done, or like I high pointed like 2.5 weeks from the end of the trip where like I stuck the last handhold and didn't feel good enough on the hold to do. There's one hard foot move before you get into easier territory. And I like feel like physically I could have done that. After that, it warmed up and got a bit more humid, and I never actually matched that high point. But it felt like I physically could have done that in the form I was. Whereas Burn of Dreams, I still feel like I feel like I need to improve.
Yeah.
So I think
that would suggest that Burn of Dreams is the harder of the boulders.
Yeah, it's very hard to tell. So I kind of was thinking about that, like when I was thinking about the difficulty of them, how they'd compare. And I actually think the one I was trying in Switzerland, one, it suits me a lot better. I can like kind of body tension static through, more statically through lots of the moves. And it's also way longer, so it's such a different style. It's like that boulder, the difficulty of it comes in making links and having like being able to maintain that tension throughout the whole sequence. Whereas Burden of Dreams is like two moves. Well, mainly two moves, like with a few easy ones in the middle.
The first one and the last one, basically.
Yeah, first and last
one. Yeah, the ones that you've currently left.
Yeah, to go back for.
Yeah, yeah. And how are you going to train for that, specifically?
Very specifically. I 3D scanned the holds on my phone.
Is that possible with your phone?
Yeah, you get. I use an app called Polycam.
Right, and you just take loads and loads of pictures.
You like move it around, it takes like 250 photos or something, and then meshes them together into a 3D image. And I was skeptical of how good it was, but it's really accurate. And so I then had somebody actually from one of the, maybe the joys of social media, somebody from read my, an article I wrote for Catalyst, messaged me on Instagram, lives in Germany, is like processes 3D prints for a living, and was like, I'll print them out for you. So he very kindly 3D printed all of these holds. I never realized how long 3D printing takes. Sent them all over, and then Core Climbing up in Sheffield then molded the 3D prints.
No way.
And I've now poured them, so I'm actually just after this going to head up and collect them on Monday.
So you've actually got the exact holds, basically.
Yeah, we tried the first left hand, which is like one of like the crucial holds, and it feels very, very similar. So that is
an amazing way of training. It's almost like doing the real boulder when you're training that specifically.
Yeah.
And even in my experience, like whenever I have, if you ever set a simulator for anything, I've never set and trained on a simulator and then not done the boulder. It is an amazing way of training. Even if the simulator is not very good.
Yeah.
Like it's so much more specific than just generally climbing. So it like pays dividends.
Yeah.
But I would say my guess would be one of the best things that would bring is a bit of toughness in the right bits of your skin.
Yeah.
Because you need to be able to go back there and have a session or two without your skin falling apart.
Yeah. And also like it's very useful because it is so far in knowing how well prepared you are. So like, if I still can't do some of the moves on this replica, I'm probably not going to
book myself. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Whereas if I can, like, do the boulder in, like...
And what degree overhanging is it?
Bang on 45.
Bang on 45.
Yeah, so...
If you just put these holds on a 45-degree board, do you think you could make it pretty similar?
I think I could make it, yeah.
Almost identical.
Yeah, not far off.
So you did all the measurements, distances between the holds.
Yeah, this same app has a little like LiDAR thing, and you can kind of like, so I've got a scan of the full boulder and you put measurements on it. So it's quite helpful.
What is the name of this app?
It's called Polycam.
That's Polycam. Is that available for free on the App Store?
I think it is. You get some scans free and then you have to pay a subscription.
Well,
I committed to, but worth every
time. Yeah, low price, I expect. Yeah. Could get you a solid deal out of it.
Yeah, there we go. Maybe I'll sponsor the podcast.
Just shout that out to the boys at Polycam.
Whoever you may be.
Yeah, man, that definitely sounds like the way to go.
There's a level of specificity of training I've never delved into. No. So I'm quite intrigued to see how that'll do.
And like, that's amazing that that guy was willing to do all that.
Yeah, no.
Get all those molds done and then core willing to make the holds for you. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was refreshing.
If that works and you climb the boulder, that is a real group effort.
Yeah, no, I feel there's been a lot of generosity I'm grateful for along the way.
Yeah, well. And there's other boulders that you briefly mentioned you tried in Finland. Was it good? Was there stuff that's worth people who aren't going to be trying Burden of Dreams going out to Finland for?
Yeah, I was actually, because similarly, I hadn't really heard of much before I went out there, like you were saying, but actually the quality of the stuff there is really good. There's some like really classic climbs. There's the Globalist. It's quite a famous one.
Oh yeah, I have heard of that.
Like really amazing.
Is that another gnarly block?
Yeah. There's some amazing rock there, and there's an area called Sipo, which has a famous roof called Hypergravity, and one I didn't get to try, but it looks amazing. Another one of Nale's called Circus Elephant Syndrome. But there's a lot of like high quality stuff. I didn't get to explore much. It's very hard to find things there because it's like very flat and forest. Mm. So it's very unpredictable where things are. But I met some locals in a climbing wall who said they'd be happy to show me some new places to develop. So I'm quite actually looking forward to exploring the rest of the area as well at some point.
Yeah. And for the do you have anything that you do for the impact of just you driving all the way over to Finland and back? Do you do anything to try and further offset your carbon emissions? Is there?
Yeah, I actually haven't looked into it for that trip. I used to do that on my I've been meaning to do that. But yeah, what I used to do when I was traveling a lot, I used to offset projects within the country. It really probably doesn't make any difference, but I used to do it within the country which I travel to.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, kind of like a nice way of doing it. But realistically, probably doesn't make any difference at all.
Because in reality, like, if you're flying to America, the people who'd probably most suffer from that are in sort of poor countries and islands.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And you're making sure that the money goes to the US of A.
Yeah, it's probably not ideal.
But means well.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, I think, like, it's another one of the things, like, definitely worth doing, won't do any harm, but doesn't tackle the root of the issue itself. So yeah, no, definitely something like I think nice to do.
But I know you you don't eat meat, do you? So is that another part of it to try and
so yeah, I actually always grew up vegetarian, which I think it's a similar, like, I was really grateful for, like, I'm like really, I feel very fortunate that that was how we were raised. And I think, like, I've always really loved animals. So perhaps it's something I've, like, been quite aware of anyway. But I think it's in, like, quite a similar case to flying. Is, like, much like the airline industry, the, like, meat industry, I kind of feel like so starkly detaches you from the reality of what you're doing. Yeah, I feel like it's a similar thing. As in, like, realistically, most people wouldn't kill a pig to have what meat is from a pig. Bacon?
Bacon, ham. Yeah. Bacon and ham.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't kill a pig to have pork, those. Yeah. To eat those foods. But, well, like, you kind of don't really see any of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's deliberately so.
Yeah, yeah,
because they wouldn't sell as much pork if you had to watch the pig getting killed.
Yeah. Which is another thing, you almost, like, you're almost like, yeah, you're paying as well to kind of detach yourself from the reality of that. Like, yeah,
yeah, much like ignorance, for sure. Yeah.
So like, I kind of feel it's like a similar thing. I kind of just feel grateful that that was always like shown to me when I was growing up, which like, I'm very, like, obviously most people don't have that. And so kind of will base what they make, like what they cook and their diet based upon a different, based upon eating meat. And it's obviously much harder. I appreciate it's much harder to kind of change that. But I think all of it, yeah, is quite, it feels like quite similar reasoning to my decisions I made with flying as well. Maybe just trying to be a bit kinder to all things around you.
Yeah. Would you, I mean, extend that to not eating certain things which might not be meat but do have a big impact, like avocados?
Yeah, no, well that is a very good point, and it's very easy to give yourself a title and feel like that's enough. Like, is it like, oh, I'm vegan, so I will, it's fine, I'm saving the world, and then have them on a diet of avocados from
jet freighted avocados from Mexico,
where coffee and avocado,
the farmer was paid in beads.
Yeah.
Access to water for his kids.
Yeah, no, it's for sure something I like try and be aware of when, like, I feel like there are a lot, accumulatively, a lot of little things you can do making an effort. I feel like I'm far from perfect, and I definitely do things which aren't ideal, but I feel I make an effort to do.
A lot better than the average, anyway. It's good that you were already a vegetarian, because you didn't have to give anything up for that one.
Yeah, I'm aware that's very easy. I had an easy ride of that one.
But are you like still conscious about eating local and trying not to eat things that are sort of out of season and therefore have been traveled? Or
I'm not. Yeah, that's another thing. Like, yeah, I'm not. I definitely can't hold myself to that. I'm quite relaxed in certain scenarios. I will eat an avocado here and there. Yeah. but I like when the option's there, I will make an effort.
Yeah, no, it's fair. I mean, I once, I'm nowhere near as good as you, I'm not as considered, but I did once read an article that was basically saying, if you're only going to do one thing for the environment, stop eating beef. So I stopped eating beef. That's why.
Oh, no.
So I did only do one thing for the environment, but I stopped eating beef.
If everyone did one thing, you know,
well, it would be bad for beef farmers, certainly. Yeah.
Most people would be better.
Slam dairy farms across the country.
Oh, good on you.
But if you're going to do one thing, apparently that was a good one to do. But yeah, so to slightly reward anybody who sat through this whole interview.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the one thing that most people would be interested in.
Hidden away at the end.
Yeah, hidden away at the end, behind all our worthy mutterings. Training.
Training.
We mentioned a bit about when you were 16 and you were absolutely overdoing it.
Yeah.
What do you do now? When you're in a training phase, obviously, not when you're on the road in a van.
Yeah, when I'm in a training phase. So, like, it will differ a lot depending on what I'm, like, at what stage in a training phase. Like, generally, I will do, like, a large chunk of, like, base training where I'll do a lot of, like, unspecific exercises and then specify much closer to, like, when I'm looking to peak. But thoughts on training in general is, obviously, training's so useful, but like as training and like the science behind training has developed so much, like it's obviously become much easier to like, it's become easier to get stronger in that, like, you can practice like quite a considered like a scientific model in which to do so. So in many ways, I think that's been like really beneficial, but I think there's many ways in which it's unhelpful, and that like it's created such like a training ethos to the point where like your training based goals can sometimes supersede climbing based goals.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. We all get like wrapped up in training now.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I know, cause I had it a lot at one point, but like, I think for me, I think it's really important to understand that I'm looking to get better at climbing, and training is a means to an end, not like the end in itself. And I think it's so easy to like lose sight of that. I think it's such a classic thing, which I really had, and I think is super common though. Like people would be like, oh yeah, like I want to be able to hang this amount of weight off this edge, or like I want, like they might be like, oh, training's going really well. Like last year I could bench press 60 kilos. Now I can bench press 90 kilos. It's it's great.
It's shocking how poorly that correlates to actual climbing performance. For me, there's almost an inverse correlation between how strong I feel with weights and how strong I feel on the wall.
Yeah. And like they hold a place, but like I feel it's very easy to like get like locked into just like having these little training based goals, which I think is counterproductive. Like sure, like training can be fun, but I think I found it's been way better for me in terms of motivation about basing how well training is going upon how well my climbing is going. Yeah. I'm actually incredibly bad compared to a lot of climbers I know at all these like training exercises. Like there was a time when I was like, I could do like a bunch of one-armers, and like I was better on a half comp on a fingerboard, but I'm definitely climbing so much better now than I was then.
Let that go.
Yeah. And like
the party trick training.
Yeah. And it actually took me a long time to be fine with that as well. Like for a long time I was like, oh, I kind of just don't really want to show people how shit I am at one arm. I think, yeah, trying to maintain climbing is the motive is quite important.
Because the assumption would be that I'm sure most people would think that you'd be able to rattle out a bunch of one armers.
Yeah, no.
Not the case.
Not at all. I mean, right now I could probably do a one-armer on both arms and that would probably feel quite hard.
Yeah. But really, realistically, that is as much as you ever need to do, isn't it? I mean, whenever I see someone like smashing out 6 one-armers, I do seriously wonder how that's going to correlate to anything. Yeah.
And similarly on like a fingerboard, like I actually find fingerboarding really useful for me because training in a half grip is, I'm not very good in a half grip, whereas there are people who are amazing in a half grip and just train in a half grip on a fingerboard, whereas actually were they to have like fully flexed fingers, so like essentially the position you'd be in a full grip but without your thumb on, then like that's probably a position that would benefit them so much more, especially climbing outside. So I've actually very rarely climbed in a half grip. Usually my pinky's always fully flexed.
So it's funny because you've reached a level in climbing where you've got a certain enigma around you with your light training. And it's kind of, it was a bit like that with Ty Landman years ago, like in London. And a little bit with the likes of Lamell and Matt Cousins back in the day, of like people knew they were really, really strong, but they didn't really know how they were doing it. And so you get these kind of like Chinese whispers.
Yeah.
like, and actually that is one of the ones I'd heard about you, is that like Aiden trains with a bent pinky.
Yeah.
And that's used as like a justification for like
Oh yeah.
I too must do that. That's the formula.
Yeah.
And all those kind of things is like you hear people doing like these exercises and then that became the thing to do.
Yeah. There's really not like a singular way. I think it's like at the end of the day, like being physically strong makes such a big difference, but it's so much of a skill-based sport, but perhaps like the physicalities of it are so much more complex than linear movements. And so like I feel like the greatest improvements to be made are always going to be specific to actually climbing. Like I do actually do a lot of like supplementary like fingerboarding and like some weights, but more just to balance me out and like kind of keep everything in check. But like I do as much actually climbing mostly on a board as I can, and then like it's kind of stuff on top of that which kind of tops up the rest, but climbing I think should always make up the majority. Yeah.
So you try and get out as much as you can even in a training phase,
climbing outside or on my board.
Would you count climbing on the board as basically as good as
I think so. I kind of like the style of the board set I've done is feels quite applicable in that it's all like I use feet follow, so the footboards are often quite complex and like and I'm using like body tension in weird positions, and I think like that feels very applicable to the rock climb.
Yeah, so that is like I think for me one of the biggest things that I've realized in recent years, which is certainly for me, but I do think in general as well, feet follow boards carry over to climbing's infinitely better
than
system boards, which is funny because system boards are all the rage now.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, Core are doing well out of it because they make the feet for basically all system boards now. But like that style is really weirdly specific to be for like everyone to be doing it all the time.
Yeah, I really. There'll be like the odd move here and there where it's applicable, but generally when you're climbing outside, the feet you're standing on will always be your handholds. And I think there's not many secrets, but I think the thing that gets me up most things outside are strong fingers, especially in full flexion, and good body tension. And there's like a whole chain there where I kind of use my back and rear delts a lot to like kind of engage everything, but everything like kind of like works quite well together, and I think that what works well. But it's very rare that like you'll just have feet exactly where you want them and you just push off them every time.
It is funny, isn't it, because I think everyone like would wants you to say, all right guys, this is the trick.
I do think there
beetroot is juice.
Beetroot juice.
just drink pint of that per day. V16 fingers.
I do kind of think like there's definitely like a training, there's like a idealistic like style of training which like is so like celebrated of being like, oh, you like can just campus most of the moves because you actually don't need your feet, and actually your legs want to be like little drumsticks because lighter legs is just lighter. And like I'd find myself being like, oh yeah, I want to be able to just like campus all these moves. That'd be great. Realistically, if you can campus a crux move of like a really hard boulder problem, but you can't do it because of the a technical heel, like nobody's really going to care.
Yeah.
With someone who just does the climb.
Yeah, you just got to do it. That's the thing.
It's not going to mean anything to you. If you then can't do the climb. Like at the end of the day, I want to get better at climbing and not party tricks. So like I think there's so much emphasis on the way things are done where it's like I feel like just kind of finding generally the most efficient way through a series of moves is the most boring looking.
Yeah.
You do them, they look really easy. Like, there's no cutting loose.
Yeah, yeah. So it's more about, yeah, climbing well. And, like, do you find that when you're climbing on the board, would you repeat stuff if you felt like you didn't climb it very well? Do you try and do it again? Or is it, like, nah, one and done?
Yeah, no, definitely will do things if I do again if I feel I've done them poorly. Actually, like, a way in which I started really focusing a lot on body tension after I injured my foot, like, in Fontainebleau years ago, because my upper body was physically much stronger, but I just couldn't connect it to my, at the time, very weak legs. And, like, it wasn't very helpful because, like, sure, I could pull on holds, but, like, I just couldn't keep any weight in my feet, and it was a very strange sensation. So I, like, started using quite good footholds and, like, just, like, extending out of them a lot. So, like, just keeping a lot of weight in them, and were a foot to come off, and I could easily hold a cut. Like, that was, like, that was, like, a no-go. Like, I'd just, like, ensure that I'd do the boulders with my feet on. And it actually is quite a good way. You can warm up as well, because, like, you're on slightly bigger holds, and, like, keeping lots of weight in your feet. So gradually, as I kind of got more used to that and they got easier and easier, I've kind of, like, either, like, used smaller footholds further away, or, like, kind of smaller handholds. And I'm, like, my warm up like tour of every board session, like, now holds, like, it's like 10 to 12, like, just really body tensiony boulders, which feels like a really good way of warming up my fingers and, like, switching on my core. And, like, that feels like a really effective way in which I've just gotten used to keeping a lot of weight in my feet.
Yeah, feet follow boards.
Useful.
And tension-based climbs. Yeah, like, trying to... So I think to distill that to be the sort of sound bite would be problems on training boards where you can't hold a cut loose, basically.
Yeah.
So you, like, they might have good feet and not necessarily, you know, that hard to avoid the cut loose, but if you cut loose, you will fall off. That's the trick
there. Yeah,
that's good. That's something for people to take away.
Yeah, good exercise.
Few
functional advice.
Yeah, exactly. A few other ones, just to see if you do any, I want to name a few things training wise and you can tell me if you do them at all. Do you do any campus boarding?
No.
When was the last time you did any campus boarding? Or was it a never situation?
I've never trained on a campus board.
Okay, campus boards, slam.
Done. They were designed for one week many years ago.
Exactly. And they should be torn out of all sorts of rest. How about campusing on board problems?
I actually used to do that a lot when I struggled a lot for power. I think a lot better than campus boarding. And yeah, kind of like helpful for developing power, especially if you've got a low body injury.
Okay, so you wouldn't rule that out, but you're not doing it right now.
Yeah, no, like, as in, like, it will... I'll sometimes have, like, a phase where I might do one session a week. Where I like campusing boulders.
Okay, now and then, occasional.
Yeah.
Fingerboard, do you two hands or one hand?
Actually, probably mostly two hands.
Interesting. And add weight?
Yeah. And I think the reason I find that useful is often it ensures that it's my fingers which are failing and not any shoulder stability at the end of a long session.
Okay. And do you do split fingers? Do you do mix it up, do some pocket work?
Don't do so much pocket work. I will do, like, three finger drag sometimes, and then will split fingers because I often struggle on front three half crimps, whereas back three
so
much better.
Again, you're looking really functional, like stuff that you're training, stuff that you don't like on climbs.
Yeah.
Rather and than just worrying about injuries and stuff like that.
It's a very safe way in which you can train your fingers like that as well, because everything's very controlled and measurable.
Okay. And how about power endurance? You do any stuff like that? 4x4s or anything like this?
Not 4x4s, but I'll do, like, boulder doubles.
Okay.
Which is kind of pound.
You're only doing half the work.
Yeah, yeah. Nearly pound.
So you do a 4x4, but you give up halfway.
Yeah, friend of halfway. Oh yeah, no, I'll start resting now.
Okay, how about circuits or endurance stuff?
Not done endurance stuff in a very long time.
No,
yeah,
because you're not doing it. I suppose I can't imagine you'd be doing anything that would be endurance rather than power endurance, really.
Yeah, no, never. Well, I have done that years and years ago, but not for a very long time.
Yeah. And would you ever, you don't ever climb on a rope? Bit of sport climbing?
I would actually quite like to. Now I've got a lot more time just climbing full time. I'd quite like to do a bit more sport climbing. I've got no aversion to it at all. I just haven't done
just
it.
Just haven't done it. Long time. It is harder to do it by yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's always self-belaying. There's some good stories.
makes it harder. Have you done like pinch block training? Did you
pinch block training? Yes, I've done quite a lot of it. Hard to tell how useful it was. I think the main reason it wasn't useful was I think I'd overlooked how much of a role your wrist plays on pinches. And generally, when you pick up a pinch block, it's in a pretty nice neutral position. Mm. Whereas when you actually use pinches, your wrist is quite like...
could be anywhere.
Yeah, and moves quite a lot. And it's a very different thing to just like pinch something in a static position. Yeah,
it's a good point, isn't it? It's much more about wrist stability. Because you've got to move your wrist as you're holding the pinch.
Yeah.
And that's where you're getting a lot of the strength from. Whereas in a pinch block, you just...
Yeah, yeah. I'd often find that like I did a phase of using pinch blocks, got loads better on the pinch blocks, and it would be a case of like I could pull on in like a position of the move and feel really solid, but then to like actually move my wrists would feel no better. So yeah, I think pinch blocks do have a place, but actually probably doing boulders on pinches is always going to be more valuable.
Yeah, again, functional. How about rings/TRX?
Yeah, I do actually really rate these, just because I think, especially if you're climbing on a board or outside, so often your fingers are the first thing to fail. It makes sense, they're tiny muscle groups, right? And you actually have a lot more energy to give to your training, like saying, like you can work your body a lot more. And you're not going to be at detriment to have a stronger body. So often we'll do that after training.
Yeah. So you will do a bit of that.
Yeah.
How about, you said you did briefly say you do some of this, but just regular gym style work, heavy weights.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ronnie Coleman.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I do quite a lot of weights. I'd say, probably most of the weight stuff I do is shoulder related. Lots for injury prevention and just strong shoulders. Generally, I have had like kind of tweaky shoulders in the past, and actually doing a lot of that weights has felt quite useful for just strengthening them and making them a little bit less susceptible to injury.
Hmm. Okay. And I know you do some stretching. That's on the docket.
Yeah, I stretch quite a lot. Yeah. Very, maybe it's not underrated, but like people should stretch. Stretching's important.
Yeah. I've gone through phases of being better at stretching and phases of giving up.
It's hard to psych yourself up for, but if you view it as a bit of a thinking time, you know.
Yeah, more time to think. I think I've run out of training models. Is there anything that you do that I haven't thought of?
In the past, I have found it quite useful, like isolating individual fingers and like kind of picking weights up in like a half crimp position. So just like single fingers at a time and like hanging weights from a sling and just picking it up off the ground. And that's felt like quite a good way in which I can really focus on specific fingers. So actually really good rehabbing strains.
Because you can go really light. And
you can go light and also like focus on a finger. So I was finding when I had tweaks, I'd like be doing some like density hangs just to like rehab, and kind of realize that I'd barely be putting any weight through the injured finger because it would be a bit sore. So all my other fingers were just picking up the slack. So it was a way in which like I could have a very measured, like,
you force it to work.
Yeah. And that was, yeah, that was definitely quite useful. And then any weaknesses as well. I've always had quite weak indexes, so that's been quite useful for that.
Mm. So we've mentioned a little bit about the style that you really like, that kind of like small in-cut edges, relatively static moves, feet on. That's your bag.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah.
What is the thing that you think you're worst at? What's the...
Okay, epitomize something I'd struggled with would be like an off balancey slopey hold.
Yeah.
Kind of you're in an out of balance position, so you're not in compression, and you have to like slap a little bit out of control to another slopey hold and then engage quickly. So you've got to move really fast in like an off balance position.
I feel like that will come up, that won't come up very often. Anywhere but font, where it will come up quite a lot, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think that kind of thing comes up a lot in font. Yeah.
That would be really interesting to see how you get on there. Mm. And that was kind of leads me to my next question, which was, are there any relatively, I mean, I shouldn't even say the word easy because easy is not the right word, but are there any lower grade boulders that you just absolutely don't get on with? Have you had any struggles with things that are easier for more people?
Oh, there's definitely things like... There's definitely boulders which, like, I've had a really hard time. Like, climbing on gritstone is, like, things I will find really hard, which lots of people will cruise. I'm trying to think. There was... Oh, what was it called? There was a boulder in when I was out in Falklands, which... I was out there with Nathan Phillips, Tara Hazen, Max Ayrton, and there was a boulder... called Solar Power, which I think it was only like 7C or something. Yeah. But you basically put an inverted knee bar in and like pressed up into this groove. I found it desperate. It was right at the end of the trip. Max made it look like the easiest boulder in the world. Nathan made it look pretty easy as well. I just couldn't do it. So just threw in the towel. But yeah, they still bring that up each time, actually. So there are like, yeah, there's inevitably like weird climbs, which like... I just can't do. I think everyone's going to have that.
So you're never going to go back to Rockland, so...
Oh, yeah.
You're never going to get solar panel.
I'm never going to close solar that power. Never going to close that account. Damn. Yeah, sleepless night.
Environmental joke there that I absolutely murdered.
Wow. Thank you. You stuck it out right to the end and listened to my whole... 3.5 hour interview with Aidan. So thank you for indulging me. Admittedly, since finishing the interview, I have thought about many other better questions that I could have asked and didn't, but I never claimed to be Louis Theroux, so what do you want from me? Jesus. But the plan going forward isn't going to be just me interviewing Aidan over and over again, although there could be a part three, so I can ask some of those aforementioned questions. But normally we're hopefully going to try and press gang and coerce some fellow climbers to come on so we can pin them down with the hard-hitting questions. But yeah, cheers. Hopefully see you again. Thanks for listening.